You're watching Behind the Screens. Grab some popcorn, fill up a drink, and take a seat. Our feature presentation is about to begin. Morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time zone you may be listening, and welcome back to another amazing episode of Behind the Screens. I'm Chris Chason, and joined as always is my co-host and best friend, Mike Lickowitt. Mike, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm doing very well tonight, Chris, and I am very excited to be here on this New Year's Eve 2021 for this episode of Behind the Screens.
Oh yeah, we want to close out 2021 with a bang, or I guess in today's case, a bit of a whimper, because let's just be honest, this movie is, Cool boy. Today's movie's going to be interesting.
Indeed. And not to mention, my friends, you all don't know this. Only me and Chris know this. It feels like we're going into an odd time loop. We already did this episode already, but due to technical difficulties, we have to do it for you guys today instead of when we previously planned on it due to unforeseen circumstances.
Yeah, but we're going to give our points across, and besides, we'll give off more points that we couldn't cover last time, which probably would give us a fresh start.
Exactly. Today we'll be covering the end of the original Fox X-Men trilogy with 2006's X-Men 3, The Last Stand, directed by Brett Ratner.
Yeah, so Bryan Singer decided to take a break, right?
Exactly. As it turns out, Bryan Singer got offered to do the next Superman movie during the early 2000s over at Warner Brothers, and subsequently left the production of X-Men 3 before any concrete plans could be made on the film. And as we'll eventually find out, he offered to take many of the cast and crew with him when he left, so Fox got Brett Ratner to put a close on the original trilogy, as it were. The film centers on, well, of course, came out in 2006. The film's story is loosely based on two X-Men comic story arcs, The Dark Phoenix Saga, written by Chris Claremont and artist John Byrne, and the storyline Gifted, written by Joss Whedon.
Well, I can already sense a problem.
Yep. The plot of this film revolves around a mutant cure that causes serious repercussions among the mutant and human populations, and of course, on the resurrection of Jean Grey. This film came out in May of 2006, 1 hour 45 minutes, and shall we get into the plot?
Might as well, get comfortable, because this is going to be a doozy.
In 1986, Charles Xavier and Eric Lenscher meet young Jean Grey at her parents' house to invite her to join their school at the X-Mansion. 10 years later, in 1996, the industrialist Warren Worthington II discovers that his son, Warren Worthington III, is a mutant as he tries to cut off his very angelic-looking wings. In the present, what I can only assume is in 2006, several years after the second movie,
yeah.
Worthington Labs announces it has developed an inoculation to suppress the X gene that gives mutants their abilities and offers the quote-unquote cure to any mutant who wants it. The cure is treated from the genome of a young mutant named Jimmy, who, from what we remember, is actually Leech from the Morlocks, from those storylines from the X-Men animated series.
Right.
Who Jimmy, quote-unquote, lives at the Worthington facility on Alcatraz Island. While some mutants are interested in the cure, most notably Rogue, once again played by Anna Paquin, many others are horrified by the announcement. Magneto reestablishes his brotherhood of evil mutants, with those who oppose the cure, mostly, quote-unquote, the Morlocks, warning his followers that the cure will be forcibly used to exterminate the mutant race if they don't take action first. With help from Pyro, Magneto recruits Callisto and several other mutants from her band of misfits. They attack the mobile prison holding Mystique to free her, as well as freeing the evil mutant's multiple man, and of course, the Juggernaut.
Oh, that should be fun.
Played by Vinnie Jones, which I thought is, oh god, I can't wait to talk about that.
Yeah.
Mystique, shielding Magneto from a cure dart from a previously thought unconscious guard, is hit by it and loses her mutant ability to shapeshift. As a result of this, Magneto abandons her and throws her to the whim, going about his evil mission. Meanwhile, Cyclops, still very much distraught over the death of his fiancée Jean Grey in X2, drives to her resting location at Alkali Lake. Jean suddenly appears to him, but as the two kiss after being away and parted for so many years, yeah, she kind of kills him. Yeah, so when they kiss, his head explodes and everything else explodes, but it's not really shown on screen.
Sure, there's the thing it's called the kiss of death, but I don't think that's what it means.
Sensing trouble, Professor X sends Wolverine and Storm to investigate. When they arrive, they find only telekinetically floating rocks, Cyclops glasses, and an unconscious Jean at the scene. When Logan and Storm return to the X-Mansion, Professor X explains to Logan that when Jean sacrificed herself to save them at the end of the previous film, she also freed the Phoenix, a dark and extremely powerful alternate personality which Xavier had telepathically repressed, aware of the Phoenix's godlike destructive potential. Wolverine is disgusted to learn of this psychic tampering with Jean's mind, but once she awakens, he discovers that she killed Cyclops and is not the Jean Grey that he once knew. The Phoenix emerges, knocks out Wolverine, and escapes to what used to be her childhood home. Magneto learns of Jean's resurrection through Callisto, and the X-Men arrive at the Grey household at the same time as Magneto and his forces. Magneto and Professor X go in, and both try to V for Jean's loyalty until the Phoenix reemerges. She completely destroys the house and disintegrates Professor X before Wolverine and Magneto's eyes before they can stop her.
I'm sorry, what?
So, yeah, both Cyclops and Professor X die in this movie.
What?
It's just like, oh my god, they're clearing the board of all the decently interesting characters. So now all we're left is Wolverine and Storm.
I mean, they're not bad, but...
Yeah, definitely. Jean decides to leave with Magneto. After interrogating a depowered Mystique, the FBI discover Magneto's base in the woods. However, the life forms in the camp are all decoy copies of multiple man. Magneto and the Brotherhood have gone to storm Alcatraz by using his magnetic manipulation powers to literally reroute the Golden Gate Bridge, lifting it into the air and flying it to the island with all his forces still on it.
That's actually not a bad demonstration of Magneto's power.
It's absolutely phenomenal, my friends. All of the remaining living X-Men confront the Brotherhood at Alcatraz, despite being significantly outnumbered, and arrive just as the military troops, who thus far have been neutralizing the attacking mutants, are overwhelmed by the Brotherhood. During the fight, Kitty Pryde saves Jimmy from the Juggernaut, who had been sent to kill him by Magneto. Wolverine has Colossus throw him at Magneto and distract him long enough for Hank McCoy, aka Beast, to inject Magneto with several of the cure syringes and thus nullifying his powers. Yeah, if I'm pretty sure we forgot to mention at this point, Hank McCoy, the Beast, is in the third film of this X-Men trilogy.
Yeah, even though his first appearance was in his human form at a scene, like, was it at a bar scene in X2?
Yeah, because, like, he was technically seen in the last movie as a cameo, played by a different actor. In this film, he's played by the ever-awesome Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, yeah.
And let me tell you, he oozes aesthetic with how amazing he is in this. Let's take a good look at this. The army reinforcements arrive and shoot at Jean just as Wolverine had seemingly calmed her down. The Phoenix reawakens by the attack and disintegrates the troops in retaliation. The Phoenix then begins to destroy all of Alcatraz and anyone within range of her powers. Wolverine, realizing that only he can stop the Phoenix due to his healing factor and adamantium skeleton keeping him alive, he's rejuvenating faster than she can kill him. When Wolverine approaches her, Jean momentarily gains control long enough to talk to Logan, begging him to save her and everyone else by taking her life. Wolverine fatally stabs Jean, killing the Phoenix, but griefully mourning her death, screaming out into the heavens as the battle is finally over, and the war that Magneto had talked about since the very end of the first movie was finally done. Sometime later, the mutants' rights are finally obtained and Xavier's school is still operating with Storm, now operating as the headmistress. The President of the United States appoints Beast as the ambassador to the United Nations on the thing about mutants. Rogue reveals to Bobby, a.k.a. Iceman, who, as you guys remember, they've been building up their relationship for the previous two movies. They had been going through a rough patch in this one.
Some relationship.
She finally told him that she had taken the cure, much to his disappointment, because he, quote-unquote, appreciated her as she was, even though he had been spending a lot less time with her and a lot more time with Kitty Pryde, played by Elliot Page. Much to his disappointment. Meanwhile, Magneto sits at a chessboard in San Francisco, seemingly human and weak. His worst nightmare. However, as Magneto gestures a metal chess piece, it wobbles slightly, showing that the cure may not have cured everything about him. Meanwhile, Moira McTaggart, who, yes, I forgot to mention, she is in this movie, if not very briefly, and it will kind of wonky the timeline a little bit, her being here.
We'll get into that.
We will definitely get to there. She checks on a comatose patient who greets her with Professor X's voice, leaving her stuttered at what has happened. So, apparently Charles Xavier is such a powerful psychic, he was able to project his mind into the body of a comatose patient before Jean murdered him halfway through the movie. So, yes, Professor X is still alive, but nobody knows. Not yet. And, my friends, that was 2006's The Plot of X-Men 3, The Last Stand, and it's... Well, it's definitely a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot to digest here, and this movie, let's just say, not a lot of people really like this movie.
Nope. The film was made on a $210 million budget, probably one of the most expensive films made back in 2006, but of course only made $460 million at the box office, making only just barely twice over what they spent on it.
I guess that's not a bad profit, but...
No. In fact, the movie was the seventh most financially successful film of 2006, so at least it got on some people's boards to some degree.
Yeah, but...
Brian Singer, who had directed the previous two installments, decided to leave the film to work on Superman Returns with Brandon Routh, right?
Yeah.
And Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor and all.
Yeah,
that
must have been fun.
X2 composer John Ottman and X2 writers Dan Harris and Michael Dougherty also left to work on Superman Returns, which is, of course, why this movie in particular has new people to make the music, new writers. It basically, they almost had to switch everything out from the directors, nearly an entire new creative staff, aside from the cast working on the characters. It really is odd to think about that. And, of course, the biggest example of that is James Marsden. The reason why Cyclops dies in this movie at all, and honestly, I think it's one of the film's biggest flaws, because even though Cyclops is one of my least favorite Marvel characters or X-Men characters in most iterations, they had the potential to fix his previous flaws from the 1 and 2, but no, James Marsden decided to leave production of the third movie to go work on Superman Returns, only filming a very limited amount of screen time because of his contract and whatnot. He couldn't leave without giving an on-screen explanation for why he was gone, and that's exactly what it was. So basically...
But a death? Really?
I mean, I guess, like, yo, he really didn't want to. Like, let me see about this initially. I know there was a reason for this. We will eventually get to it. Singer had not even defined the storyline for the third film before he left, so they had to scrounge up an ending on whatever storylines were popular at the time. And, of course, the Phoenix Saga.
Let's just be honest here. The Dark Phoenix Saga is one of the most iconic comic stories of all time.
Of course, if it's,
it's hard
if it were
to,
not.
It's hard to, as we've seen, it's kind of really hard to adapt it.
Well,
right.
I mean...
Adapt it right.
Adapt it in live action right. Because when me and Chris viewed the X-Men animated series for the first time, we thought it was handled pretty well.
Yeah, because like the Dark Phoenix Saga was handled pretty well in the 90s cartoon.
Exactly.
Because I think Chris Claremont had a hand in the show, in the show's episodes with that.
Exactly. It was so darn well-y handled. The problem is, this movie is too short to have two story arcs running throughout it.
Yeah.
At like 1 hour 45 minutes, they clearly did not have enough time to focus on the Cure story as well as the Dark Phoenix Saga.
Yeah, look, we know the Dark Phoenix Saga is popular, we know people love it, but shoehorning it in alongside stuff about a mutant cure, you're gonna hit some bumps in the road.
Exactly, my friend. Before we go back on that, Matthew Vaughn, who was initially hired as the new director, left due to personal and professional issues with Fox and was replaced with Ratner. Thankfully, Matthew Vaughn would return to the X-Men franchise to direct and work on X-Men First Class in 2011.
Right, which we have our own thoughts on that, but we'll get to that when we review it.
Yep. Thanks to the amazingly high budget, the incredible visual effects at the time of this film was made by 11 different studios all at the same time, working on effects for the costumes, for the powers, for the sets, for the CGI. Everything was handled from many different locations, and it really, really shows. This film is a computer-generated marvel, especially for the time. I can't even imagine seeing this film in the theaters as it is, of course. Yeah. Most of the praise of this film came from its action scenes, but criticism for its lack of depth and nuance compared to the first two movies.
Yeah, because, the first X-Men movie established the lore on how mutants were. X2 expanded on that. Then you got this movie that's just...
It's just there.
Yeah, honestly, that's the best way to describe it.
It tries to keep things going, but my God, when you watch these movies as many times as we have, you can definitely see the difference.
Yeah, let's put this out. Let's do a little analogy here. The first X-Men movie is iconic, but then, for anyone who's a gamer out there, X-Men 3 is kind of like Mega Man 5. Yo, it's just there.
If you guys know that reference, I'm pretty sure that you'll get it.
It's just there.
This is simply my thoughts on the matter. If Fox was not so dead set on making a trilogy and keeping the films going in succession, like the MCU or the DC Cinematic Universe, if they had not just wanted to do a trilogy and then make prequel movies after that, which was the original plan, if they had done 4 or 5 films, this film could have been solely focused on the cure. Because when it is focused on the cure, it's pretty good.
Yeah, because when focusing on the cure, it's honestly really cool and delivers a strong message. There are people who want it and people who don't want it.
Yes, and of course, besides, this was actually done in an episode of the original animated series, once again, but not dragged out for a full movie's length, maybe 22 to 45 minutes.
Yeah,
have done. You could have saved Jean's resurrection for the end credit scene of the third movie and made the whole fourth film about her resurrection, and that could have been the end of the story. Well, because of course, your stuff for now, you introduce Beast in the third movie, keep the story of everybody going and so forth. But of course, you have to roll with the circumstances as you come, and we're kind of stuck with this movie as is.
Yeah, so...
As is now, we now go into the casting portion of this. We're actually going to be doing something different for all of our future movie reviews. We will not talk in depth about the entire cast. We will only be talking in depth about half of it, while of course giving the cameo treatment to the second half.
Ah, perfectly balanced, as all things should be.
Yep. First up is Hugh Jackman as Wolverine for the third time.
Honestly, kind of a letdown compared to X2.
Yep.
I know it wasn't focused on him, but he's only there as the cool teacher for the X-Men.
I know. It seems to want to continue the story from the previous movies, with of course him being an angry loner and not wanting friends. But then this movie hammers in the theme and the story arc of him working as a team, even though he's done great working in teams in the previous two films. Heck, X2 was all about him making a team out of the disgruntled teenagers of Iceman, Rogue, and Colossus, and the like of that. So I mean, I guess it was not really all that needed to be done with this movie, but I suppose with everything that we got, I suppose that it was just fine.
Yeah.
Hugh Jackman was pleased to see that the script allowed Wolverine to expand his character choices, as instead of questioning whether he would remain a loner or join the X-Men, Wolverine now is asked if he will play a leadership role in the X-Men. So basically what you're saying is the movie just asked him a different set of questions than what was already asked of him. So it's it just keeps the questions going. Don't worry, the story's going somewhere, just wait another 10 years.
Oh, God, no.
So I will say, I definitely enjoyed Hugh Jackman's performance. He still gives off the disgruntled biker look. One of the reasons why I adore him so gosh darn much.
Yeah, because he knows how to be Wolverine.
He's so charismatic, so funny, so stern and likable across all fields. A true hero through and through.
Absolutely.
So I definitely approved of that. Next, you have Halle Berry as Aurora Monroe's Storm. Now, I know I put her as the butt of many jokes in the other two movies with her awful hair wig aesthetics and her fake African accent. It's like, I know that that stuff really didn't do a lot of good things for me. I really have to commend her for sticking it out, though, however. Barry has stated during interviews for the second movie that she didn't want to come back for a third film unless Storm had been given a more significant presence comparable to that of the original comics. Like, she wanted the recognition that was owed to her instead of just being the black woman with lightning powers.
Yeah.
And you know what? In this movie, that it actually did work out, leading to the larger role that she had in this film alongside Wolverine.
Yeah, not to mention the fact, like, the whole headmistress assignment thing at the end of the movie.
I know.
And a few other things. So
which is actually true, because Storm lead the X-Men for like a while in like the comic books?
I've heard, yeah, it's mainly been a thing, mainly like I want to say since her like first appearance or sometime like leading into the 90s.
Yeah, like, you know, it bounces between her and Cyclops leading the
X-Men,
which
yes.
I think is great. Let me tell you that.
The Storm seems like the person who would lead.
Yeah, I'm very much proud of her. Even though, of course, her hair is a lot better in this movie, her accent is a little better, but still not that great. I can always appreciate somebody sticking out a role to the very end if the circumstances were to.
Oh, yeah.
A line. Halle Berry declared that her ethnicity made the actress identify with the Cure plot. When I was a child, I felt that if only I could change myself, my life would be better. As I've gotten older, I've come to terms with what utter nonsense that is. The character was given a more modern haircut. The character was given a more, you know, stylized choice with her clothes and whatnot by the costume designers, opted to give Storm more black outfits, a color she only wore in the leather costume for previous films to make her quote-unquote tougher and sexier. It was weirdly a thing that they were doing to Halle Berry in the early 2000s. They put her in these weird leather outfits in the hopes of driving up sex appeal for the male demographic.
Oh, that just seems like a lame excuse.
Because, yeah, you and I once watched a thing about the 2004 Catwoman movie about how they tried to justify the sexist costume choices in that for Miss Berry.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to justify, like, changing up her outfit once again in this movie, too.
Were the mid-2000s always like that?
Pretty much, yeah. Like,
great! I thought the '80s were nuts.
Because, yeah, like, if you've seen as many early 2000s films as I have, you know that was a crazy time. While we were tiny, crazy nonsense was happening.
Yeah, and we didn't know better until now.
Nope. I will say this is probably one of my favorite Halle Berry performances, if not for the fact that they improved her role going forward in the franchise.
Yeah, absolutely.
If we were ever to see her again, I'm sure it would be improved even more so. So check out Miss Halle Berry in any movies you may see her in after this.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we have Ian McKellen as Magneto, Eric Lenscher.
Again,
I
felt like another step down compared to X2.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I'm just sorry, because X2 is just so good.
I know, it really is, and you can just feel him oozing the amazingness out of him. Ian McKellen is grown to be definitely a really good actor that I can enjoy watching in many things,
totally.
More animated or not. I may say, okay, so maybe he kind of bores me in some movies, but movies like this, when he plays characters like this, I can't deny how much I
like them. Yeah, like, the scene he's, like, when he's rallying the Brotherhood, that's a Magneto that I'm familiar with.
Yep.
Not to mention the fact he literally moved the Golden Gate Bridge with his powers.
Oh, I know. It just shows that is epic.
Saying this. Magneto is one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe because not only he can manipulate basically the whole metal, he can basically manipulate the magnetosphere of the Earth's core with his powers.
Oh my god, that's freaking phenomenal.
Not to mention, as we saw in X2, he can manipulate the iron in your blood.
Which is scary as heck, let me tell you that much. Well known for his homosexuality, Ian McKellen found a parallel of the Cure with many prejudices given to the LGBT community and all of the different ethnic groups that live in not just America, but the entire world.
Absolutely.
It's truly abhorrent to me, as it would be if a person said, I need curing of my sexuality. Or if someone said that black people could take a pill that would cure them of being black. And just, I love that. Like, I love how his angriness of the fact that the U.S. government and science divisions would do this, to think that taking away something that makes people unique would be a good thing. Basically saying is how, you know, you look different than me, so we have to cure you and make you like everybody
that's
else.
Just, that's
really,
like oof.
I will always adore Stan Lee for making this. Like, I know that many people will argue saying, saying that the X-Men is a very blatant and not very nuanced allegory for racism, but you can't deny it works.
It was a bold attempt, and that's why it works so well, despite the comics not selling so well.
Exactly. Like, the fact that matters, it really calls out humanity's negative traits. It shows that we do ostracize what makes us different. We do hate what is not the norm. And it shows that Magneto is a noble individual, even if he does horrible, horrific things to meet
especially,
his goal.
Look, Stan Lee was ahead of his time, because I remember hearing an interview where he was talking about how he made Spider-Man. And he just said, like, he gave Spider-Man a mask, saying he could have been black, he could have been Hispanic, he could have been, like, a young kid or someone under there.
Exactly.
It didn't matter who he was under there, but he was a hero.
The mask doesn't make the man. The actions do.
Yeah, and the same goes for the X-Men and what Magneto does. Sure, he's a jerk, and sure, he's a villain and wants mutant supremacy, but you can't deny that he's trying his best here to make the world a better place in his own way.
Exactly. Especially since he is 100% right. He's just going about it the wrong way.
Exactly. I mean, aren't a lot of villains like that?
Yeah. Well, yes, some of them. True. It just, like, depends on who.
You're right.
Who you ask. I will say Magneto had some pretty good lines in this movie.
Yeah, I will admit
Magneto being "What have I done?" This is like, he has no idea.
Magneto was honestly one of the best parts of this movie.
Yeah, I'd like to definitely say that he definitely had his good moments, especially during the ending when you shown that the cure is not permanent. We will be seeing Eric Lenscher as Magneto once again.
Oh, yeah.
But where and when, we'll just have to find out.
It'll take time.
Next is Sir Patrick Stewart once again coming back as Charles Xavier, even if it is only for a little bit amount of time.
He did okay.
Patrick Stewart continued to give the amazing performance he did in the first two movies, even if his time was cut short halfway through it and the X-Men were without their mentor character.
Yeah.
In fact, can we really call this an X-Men or maybe just a half old man, half young man? Because, like, yo, mind you, Jean is evil. There's no Jubilee. Beast only just comes in this movie, and like Storm and Wolverine, yes. Rogue is younger than she should be, but technically she's still Rogue. Gambit is nowhere to be found. It's like mostly the kids, Colossus, Kitty Pryde, and Iceman. So, really, when Professor X and Cyclops die, that really doesn't leave a lot of the heavy hitters left.
Yeah, you got that right. Like, at least on the veteran side. On the young side, yikes.
Yep. Patrick Stewart signed on to the movie without knowing that Charles was going to die. Oof. He was completely unaware of that when he came on to do the next movie. And not meeting original director Matthew Vaughn, both would actually meet to do other stuff, including where Stewart was filming 11th Hour. But eventually, Brett Ratner called to introduce himself as the new director. So basically, he had no idea what the heck was going on with this movie. He thought he was going to be playing regular old Professor X, doing some awesome fighting stuff and telekinetic amazingness. But then he dies halfway through the movie. And what did it all matter? Well, I'll tell you what it mattered to do. It happened in a story many years later. Just know that Patrick Stewart tried his very best at all of his amazing inflections and his willingness to never give up on Jean. But before we move on to the next character, let it just be known that this movie got the ball rolling on many of my negative thoughts about Charles Xavier.
Yeah, I mean, I may love Marvel too, but even I can't deny not every character is perfect.
No.
And I feel like the way they handled Charles Xavier, not just in this movie, but for the rest of the franchise, yikes.
I think that the biggest drop in his character's quality, I mean, the OG portrayal of Patrick Stewart, was of course learning that he put mental blocks on Jean without her knowing to keep the Phoenix suppressed.
Yeah.
And of course, without her knowing, it shows that he is, that even though Charles Xavier is always trying to work for a better tomorrow, always working to make the world a better place for humans and mutants, he is not above crossing ethical lines to do what has to be done, and he thinks that just because he does good things 99% of the time, he can do bad things 1% of the time, and everything will be A-okay.
Mike, you do realize that 1% is still 1%.
You tell this dude that, because after the Phoenix emerges, every single second Charles Xavier is still on screen, the negative taste is always in the back of your throat after he keeps saying, "She needs help. I can talk. I can fix it." Like, I love how that's his entire character for the rest of the movie before Jean obliterates him. That he still thought he could fix what he broke, but even though we all knew that was
impossible. It's broke, and probably can't be fixed.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly what I'm saying. So even though I loved Patrick Stewart in a lot of different things, the more so we go throughout the films I've seen him in. His portrayal of Charles Xavier is not as good as it was in the previous two films,
yeah.
But it was good enough, serviceable, until we see him in future movies.
That is true, yeah.
And now we have Miss Famke Janssen, once again playing Jean Grey, a.k.a. the Phoenix.
All I can say
class
is...
Class 5 mutant.
I actually didn't
know that mutant classes had, like, ranking levels.
Well, yeah, because either usually you got... Usually, now recently, it's more like alpha level, beta level, or omega level mutants.
Yeah, which is actually really, you know, interesting. I honestly did not know that a lot of these different mutants
were
I'm guessing
class 5 means really powerful.
I'm guessing, like, yo, class 5 is, like, Iceman, Marvel Girl, Legion, Magneto, Proteus... Vulcan, Hope, Summers. Oh,
Those guys are all powerful mutants.
Yeah, so it's
so basically class 5 is another fancy way of saying omega level mutant.
Yep. So now in this movie, Jean is completely given into the influence of a quote unquote dark alternate personality called the Phoenix.
That's now, honestly, I'm gotta raise a red flag here. That's not how it works.
No.
In the original comics, the Phoenix Force was not a dark personality.
No.
It was a cosmic force that was able to create and destroy life.
Yes.
Among other things.
It was absorbed into Jean during one of the X-Men's adventures in space, and it eventually seemed like it was a positive influence, helping the X-Men defeat a quote-unquote bad force in the universe, and then, of course, taking Jean along with him. But originally, when the Phoenix experienced, like, what do you call those? Sensations?
Yeah.
Like, sensations of good, bad, happy, sad.
Like, actual emotion.
Yeah, it wanted more. It wanted so much more, it was willing to destroy the universe to get it. And of course,
basically, it's power lust taken to an nth level degree.
This movie just seems like they put this character into this movie without fully understanding what they were doing.
It's like they didn't even fully read the comic.
No, it's like they were told from the higher ups at Marvel, hey, there's this awesome comic story called The Phoenix Force, where Jean Grey, the nice redhead, turns into this really sultry evil redhead. You guys can do that, right? Sure.
And I'm sure someone was like, shouldn't we, like, read the comic first?
No, no reading. We have to write this.
What?
Do it right.
Oh my god.
I should, like, probably mention it that one of the guys, like, the two people that wrote the script for this film were Simon Kingsberg and Zach Penn. Zach came up with the story for the previous films, at least for X2, if my knowledge is correct. Yes, he came up with the story for X2, but now he officially was co-writing the screenplay alongside Simon Kingsberg, who would go on to be one of the film franchise's longest-running producers.
Yeah, for good or for ill. He produced some of the other X-Men movies, right?
Yeah, most of, if not all of the films in the back half of the 13-film saga.
Oh, great.
So basically, he was a big pioneer at Fox for this. But of course, it still does not exude him from making these kinds of mistakes. The writers, Simon and Zach, specifically describe the multiple personalities things as an Oedipal drama played out, where the Phoenix was someone embodying a Greek goddess, while Jean Grey kept the character as a human grounded in Freudian terms, a victim, a schizophrenic. And, you know, they're basically saying, oh yeah, I really don't know how to say this without sounding mean, because they clearly did not understand Jean Grey at all.
Yeah, now, they didn't.
Now, okay, this is something that will go back in our previous reviews and our future reviews of the X-Men Fox saga. Let me tell you, we've been very much sugarcoating how we felt about Jean Grey in these, you know, movies, about how she's always there and always kind to people. She's supposed to be the character where people can cry on her shoulder. She's kind of like a nicer version of Dinah Lance from DC.
Yeah.
But of course, in these movies, she's just there to be someone for Cyclops and Wolverine to pine over.
She's someone
that needs to be worried all the time and needing to run into action to rescue somebody. They never really get her all the way right. And that's kind of the same for the future films, too. And yes, Jean is seen after this, even though she's quote-unquote dead. They found ways to work around that.
Prequels, people!
We'll be sure to get back to you on this. So I will go even harder on it in the later movies. Just think of this as a precursor to that.
Oh, when we eventually get to the actual Dark Phoenix film, Mike is going to go nuts.
To mark the change of Jean Grey to the Phoenix, her wardrobe focused more on red clothes and everyday fabric in contrast to the leather costumes shown in the previous movie. They figured that changing her clothes clothes would change her personality too.
What? Wait. Where's the logic in that?
It so fits into the mindset of the early 2000s because if you dressed in black, you had to act moody. If you wore yellow, you were happy.
If you were red, you were a psychopath?
You were like angry, yeah, like freaking Cletus Cassidy.
Oh, God, that guy.
He always wore red. Eddie Brock always wore black. That sort of thing. Everyday fabric. The digital makeups also made Jean's face darker with her skin showing veins, her eyes showing black. They wanted to show that when the Phoenix was in charge and Jean was in charge, we would always know. So I will say this is probably the weakest portrayal of Jean in this movie, and as sad as I am that we had to put her out of her misery, it was probably for the best. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess so.
And now we have Anna Paquin back as Marie, a.k.a. Rogue. And I'll say, even though I was very mad that they gave all of Jubilee's stories to Rogue in order to make her more sexy, appealing to the audience, even though Rogue is honestly one of the most attractive X-Men, quote-unquote X-people out there. I'd like to definitely say Anna Paquin... She frustrates me in this movie so hard.
I mean, was she like that? I mean, she didn't frustrate you in the previous two movies,
no,
right?
No, because even though I was upset about them giving, like I said, Jubilee's story to her, at least she played the story well.
Yeah, she tried her best.
This movie just gives her the cliche, ooh, boyfriend drama crap. Ugh. And it's like, literally, like in this, like one of her first lines in this movie is, you're a boy, Bobby. Your mind's only on one thing. God, I hate that.
That seems a bit... And also, that's a little stereotypical, if I'm being honest.
It's so stereotypical. I hate it so much. It's the cliches of the early 2000s. Even though I love those cliches to death because we grew up with them.
Yeah, of course.
Hardcore.
We have nostalgia for it, but we can't let nostalgia blind us.
No, we really can't. Rogue's main thing in this entire movie is her wanting to take the cure so she can kiss boys. That's literally her whole
If I had that power, I mean, I'd take the cure, but even I have to admit, what?
Anna Paquin declared that while Rogue did not have a very strong presence in this movie, the quote-unquote adult decisions the character was forced to make do made more intensity on the emotional side. So she's saying, so basically she's trying to justify her lesser role in this movie compared to 1 and 2 because she had more harder decisions to make.
Really?
She had to choose to either take the cure or not, stay with Bobby or leave him, stuff like that. And I really didn't consider it very much at all, especially with how the movie ends. Honestly, I'm very glad that Rogue is seen more in the future movies because the way her character originally ended here, I was not happy with at all.
Let me tell you,
after Rogue takes the cure, she can finally be with Bobby, which made me feel amazingly angry because Wolverine specifically talked to her earlier in the movie saying, I hope you're not thinking about doing this for just some boy. And literally she is.
And I'm like, oh Rogue,
girl, you stupid. And it's literally because I do check the deleted scenes out of every movie I watch whenever they're available to see what could have been and what should have been and stuff like that. And one of the scenes specifically was Rogue not taking the cure and leaving Bobby, then the movie would have ended as normally done. And that would have been so much better for me.
That actually does sound a lot better. Because then they could eventually tease Gambit and there we go.
Yeah, like literally, like that was originally my pitch. She would have walked out of the room with her books in hand. She would have dropped her books, knocking into somebody. The person with a French Louisianian accent would have tried to help her up, but she would have adamantly said, no, I don't need a boy's help. And he would have said, really? Maybe I can change your mind, Cher. And it would have been
Gambit.
So it's like that would have shown if they had not stopped at the trilogy, they would have kept it going with them as like a Wolverine leading the X-Men team of Rogue and Gambit and Iceman and all these other characters, giving them more screen time, advancing all that. But
that's not what happened.
So as I will say, Anna Paquin does a good enough job in this. She would do much better in later roles in this saga. But for right now, she did fine frustratingly so, but, you know, she did fine.
Yeah, yeah, that's the best way to put it.
Now, let me just double check on who we got to go to next. Is Kelsey Grammer as Hank McCoy.
I know you already harbled on him in a lot, and you like him. I like him, too. He honestly did a good job as Beast.
Hank McCoy is one of my favorite members of the X-Men. A single shadow of a doubt with having a terrifying outward appearance, but being very, very intelligent and calm-natured.
Yeah, Beast is honestly one of the smartest people in all of Marvel.
Yes, it really does show that how he was willing to work with the U.S. government, work with the X-Men to solve the problems of Magneto, using pacifism and clarity whenever possible, but never forgetting to let loose when the time came, like at the final battle with
Absolutely.
Beast, with the vest on, ready to, like, using his quoting in the fighting, and then said, oh, forget it, and just leaps into battle.
Yeah, like, that honestly, let's just agree, Beast was at his best at the final battle.
Yes, it definitely was. Especially with him being so kind-natured and so awesome to watch. Yeah. Every single thing about it is because, let me tell you, every single time we see people working through makeup, they have to try harder as possible. Otherwise, they become the worst part of the movie or the best part of the movie.
Yeah, worst part is Mike Myers in The Cat in the Hat.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was having trouble finding an example, and you gave me a perfect
and,
example.
Best part is sort of similar. Jim Carrey in The Grinch.
Yeah, that's a perfect example right there. And Kelsey Grammer, despite having to work 3 hours a day to apply his Beast makeup, including fur and stuff, involved applying latex prosthetics before painting his eye areas, his lips blue, various hair pieces and wigs, as well as a muscle suit covered with hand-punched fur. It's like this guy was carrying twice his body weight every single day making this movie, and he still gave a stellar
performance. He took it like a champ!
And he really, really did. So I will say is, though, if you like Beast from the X-Men cartoons and comics, you will love this iteration of him played by Kelsey Grammer. I'm really glad that I was very sad that we didn't get to see more of him in the future movies. We did, but it was very little.
Yeah.
Let me just say, I will always consider Kelsey Grammer the original Beast.
Me too.
And whoever we get in the future will be nice, but Kelsey Grammer stays up there for
yeah.
me right now. Now let's go to James Marsden as Cyclops once again.
Should we really? Because he barely has any promise.
Yeah, no, he was barely in this movie till the very much so-and-so.
No, but this time, yeah, because like we said, he left early. He left the set so he could be part of the new Superman movie.
And it really did show how little I cared for James Marsden. As much as I think he's a very gorgeous, talented man, it showed just how little he was trying or how little he was given. Like, it was always on a part of the creators or him doing all these things.
Yeah.
James Marsden saw no problem in having a smaller role in this movie, as the prior films opted to feature Hugh Jackman as Wolverine as the standout character rather than him as the leading man of the X-Men. It's difficult when you have however many new characters that you're trying to introduce to an audience in 90 to 120 minutes to give everyone their due. He was fine with having a smaller role to close out his story arc so you know he could move on with his career. And you know, I really do feel bad about that because I wanted to see him really do good as Cyclops. I wanted to see a good live-action version of him. And unfortunately, we honestly didn't get that a lot in these movies. We got it the most in the first movie. He was kidnapped for half of the second, and then he dies in the first third of this one.
God, so Fox really doesn't know what to do with Cyclops.
No,
do they?
No, not even in the later movies. They have no idea. Hopefully another company will, but we'll just have to see about that. Let's see who we have to check out next. I believe we can look at about 5 more characters. Let's take a look at Miss... let me try hard not to butcher her name. Rebecca Romijn as Raven Darkholm Mystique. Now, just for the previous movies, Mystique was mostly there for sex appeal to be Magneto's second in command and not really saying much, chewing the scenery at times with her blue makeup. And of course, you know, they still continue the same shtick in the previous two films of this one.
Yeah.
She protects Magneto, she does amazing stunts, she sometimes steals the show with all of her scenes and stuff like that. My favorite of which being, when I get out of here, I'm going to kill you, as she's looking like a little girl.
That was honestly terrifying, but also funny.
I know. It works so much to the film's benefit on so many gosh darn levels.
Yeah.
And it really does suck that she got turned into a regular human by the end of the movie.
Yeah, she had to be cured.
Yeah, she had to be cured, and Magneto threw her away, giving one of another one of his iconic lines from this movie, "Pity. You were once so beautiful.
And it's I'm looking like, she's still beautiful, dude!
I mean, but no, now she sees her as one of the human vermin that he's trying to exterminate. It really just goes to show that as noble as Magneto is trying to be, he's really just as shallow as the humans he hates.
Well, humans are capable of that, regardless if you have superpowers or not.
I know. I mean, then of course she rats out Magneto to the FBI, and then she really does nothing else in the movie. She's mostly there just to continue on because she was in the previous films.
Yeah.
And she did so much more stuff in there. I don't know if it was because of the movie's reduced runtime that they could've didn't been. Have enough time to it do all been. This cool stuff. But, yeah, if you guys liked her in the first movie, too, then you'll like her in this to a decent degree. Now let's go on to Sean Ashmore as Bobby Drake, correct? I believe that's correct. Yep. So I'll definitely be saying about this, Bobby was definitely one of my low-key favorite characters. Like I said, the scene with his parents in the second film, one of my favorite scenes in all 13 movies.
Yeah, it was great. But happened here, though?
I know him just deciding, I can't touch my girlfriend, so I'll just go talk to another girl that she's kind of friends with without telling her. What a douche move. But then, of course, it's kind of what guys would normally do.
Well, yeah, we can't argue with that. We're dudes, and we've seen it happen.
Yeah, it's really a terrible thing to do, but it leads to one of the movie's more cuter moments. But it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth when what he's doing to Rogue. When he takes Kitty Pryde outside, freezes the park fountain, and they skate across it. Which is a very cute scene. I like that. That's very nice.
Yeah.
But until, of course, it's what leads Rogue to go take the cure in the first place. That's basically the straw that broke the camel's back. Really enough, so it's like, dude, if you just care about who she is instead of what you want, maybe you two could have worked out better.
Yeah.
But of course, then again, they do work out good enough at the end of the movie, so I really don't know. They have, he'll leave on better terms with that. Bobby does have an amazing fight scene with Pyro at the end.
Yeah, because remember, Pyro turned to be on Magneto's side during the second movie.
Yep.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, here comes the retribution.
Yep.
And then it just happens.
It just happens. It's a decent fight between Aaron and Sean, with them finally being able to cut loose, use their fire and ice powers to their fullest ability.
Yeah, then you get evaporation.
Ashmore's commitments to X-Men 2 made him decline Bryan Singer's invitation to play Jimmy Olsen in Superman Returns. And I think that he would have actually made a good Jimmy Olsen had he been able to play the role, not going to lie. The actor was content with his bigger role in this third installment, after Bobby joined the X-Men main team in the second half of X-2. As during the previous production, he wondered, when do I get to freeze something or get into a fight? He's mostly there for teen drama. And he finally gets to be involved with the fights. Definitely one of my favorite things about his character in this movie. Speaking of, let's talk about Aaron Stanford now as Pyro.
Oh, man. Yeah. As we talked about from the first two movies, Pyro's a jerk.
Yeah, he's the perfect stereotypical early 2000s bully that becomes a bad guy by the end of the second movie.
Yeah, now he's on Magneto's side, so we basically get to see a fallen from grace. Although, he's no Anakin Skywalker.
Nope. He basically takes over Mystique's role in the movie as soon as she becomes a human. He becomes Magneto's new second in command. Should I be saying so bold on this?
That's about right.
Takes over all of that role. He gets the badass emo stuff. He gets to say the one-liners, burning things, which is honestly really nice, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
Let it be known that any version of Pyro is better than the animated series version of Pyro.
Yeah, the animated series was a real tosser.
Real tosser. But of course, this version, Aaron did a very good job with what little stuff he was given.
Oh, absolutely.
Let me just take about this. Ability to manipulate fire. The actor was comfortable with returning to the role, particularly following him starring in the 2006 remake of the 1977 horror film The Hills Have Eyes, which had an exhausting shoot in the Moroccan desert. While Pyro was nowhere near as physically demanding, the characters pretty much stand and deliver. Stand there and throw fire at people. There's really no acrobatics. I just stand there and the effects people do the rest. Which is honestly really funny when I'm thinking about it. This guy had several months filming a shoot in the desert. He was burning alive each and every day, so coming back to play a character who throws fire should have been very easy.
Sounds very cathartic also.
Yep, and now let's talk mainly in depth about our last character, Vinnie Jones, a.k.a. Kane Marco the Juggernaut.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Vinnie Jones was originally an English soccer player, or football if you're an international fan.
Yep.
He was big and he was violent on the field.
Yep. So, you know, he decided to go into acting after a while.
And what better than the Juggernaut?
Yep. I've actually seen him in several of his movies. He actually starred in the Arrow TV show, the remake of Gone in 60 Seconds, which I did see.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I saw him in something else.
Yeah. Who did he play on Arrow?
He was the character Brick. Which is actually weird too, because like I remember Brick was Pyro's sidekick in the X-Men animated. No, that's Marvel.
No, Brick is a DC mob boss. He's basically like an evil Luke Cage.
Getcha. So basically he played evil Luke Cage in the Arrowverse. Yep. Which is honestly really nice.
That's not bad.
Let me take a good look see at his stuff right here. The film's version of Juggernaut is depicted as a mutant, and his relation to Charles Xavier is never mentioned. If you guys know, Juggernaut is not really a mutant.
No, he's not a mutant. He got his powers based on a magic gem.
Like, isn't it like the helmet that makes him his power?
No, there's an actual gem. Time to tap into my inner comic nerd here. But back in the comics, Kane Marco and Charles Xavier fought in the Korean War. Was it Vietnam or Korea?
I'm pretty sure it was...
I think it was Vietnam.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
One of those wars.
It could be Korean, because you're like, mind you, the X-Men were from the 60s.
Right, so Korean War. So, Kane Marco accidentally stumbled into a cave, and Charles thought he was dead. But in that cave, Kane found a gem. The Crimson Gem of the god Sidorak.
Yes.
And with that gem, he became the god Sidorak's avatar on Earth, a human Juggernaut.
Which I think is honestly great. The Juggernaut is one of my favorite Marvel villains of all time, with his big bulky appearance, with his big bolstering of being able to break everything he touches.
But
through.
He's vastly underrated, because for X-Men stories, they always give Magneto or another villain the spotlight.
Exactly.
Juggernaut is mainly just seen as literal muscle.
Yep.
And this dude cannot be stopped, because this guy has tangled with the likes of the Hulk, and even the Hulk has a hard time stopping him. His center of gravity is so immense, he's able to stop Thor's hammer in midair.
Yep, indeed. So,
yeah, this guy is powerful.
This guy is actually Charles Xavier's half-brother, step-brother.
You could say half-brother, really, because... Yeah. Because Kane's dad married Charles' mother.
Step-brother, then, because, half-brother is same parent, only, like, a one same parent. And
yes.
That's it. So, like, basically, he does appear in this. Matthew Vaughn was the one who casted Vinnie Jones when he was originally supposed to be the director of this movie before leaving, who also met producing the Guy Ritchie gangster movies where Jones began his acting career. And, of course, me, I love Guy Ritchie. I'm going to be watching my sixth film of his. I've seen...
Yeah, Guy Ritchie's movies are interesting. We'll have a lot to talk about them.
Yep. The actor had to go through a 4-hour makeup process to make him look like the Juggernaut, which included a muscle suit and prosthetic chin, which is why his face looks like that.
A prosthetic chin?
Which is crazy, too.
What?
Because, like, mind you, they had to make his chin extend out to where the helmet ended.
No, I get that, but what?
It's so weird, too, because they had a huge lump on his face that clearly looked
fake. I get the fact that at the time they couldn't make someone as big as the Juggernaut, but have you seen Deadpool 2?
Well, yo, mind you, then again, special effects were much better back in 2018 than they were in 2006.
Fair enough. But still, yeah, like, let's just be honest here. Juggernaut may look weird, but he was alright.
The costume tried to retain the bullet-shaped helmet of the comics, which... I finally get that. He's literally a human bullet going through things.
That's why bullets have a hard time stopping.
Which I love that now. That makes me love him even more.
Which makes me wonder, what could stop the Juggernaut?
Oh, I'm pretty sure it will.
Oh, wait. Nothing can.
No. Okay, so now we're going into the lightning round of the characters. Elliot Page as Kitty Pryde.
Yeah, so we want to make this very clear. Elliot Page is a transgender actor.
Yes, and let me tell you, having a transgender actor in the X-Men film saga only makes me appreciate the films even more so, even though it was many, many years before they ended up coming out.
Yeah, we're going to use the they because we don't want to, like, misgender and get
hate. I try very hard to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah, but we do know this. Elliot Page has now become an amazing actor, and they are seen now on the Umbrella Academy on Netflix, which is an awesome show.
Yep, go watch that. If you appreciated their performance in this movie, as well as films like Hard Candy, go watch this.
Yeah, and Kitty Pryde is honestly, she's one of my favorite X-Men. She's honest, she's young, she's jubilant, not trying to be Jubilee.
No.
And Kitty's power is interesting. She's able to walk through pretty much anything.
I know. I love that. It's so much fun. They were part of one of the greatest memes of cinema history, so honestly, can't be any
more bad. Oh, that one.
Paige said, I thought, well, when else am I going to have a chance to wear a leather suit and run through exploding things? Why not be a superhero for a change? Good on you, Elliot Page. Good on you.
Wait, hold on. Dress in a leather suit and run through things where explosions happen. Was that super? Is that how Martin Scorsese looks at superhero movies?
Yeah, it's probably it. You know what I'm saying? We have Peter Rasputin as Colossus. He did fine, just like he did in the previous movies.
Wait, he's not actually Russian, though, is he?
Let me do a double check. He's Canadian.
Oh.
Canada's close to Russia,
so it's okay.
I thought that he was fine.
Yeah, honestly. He did fine as Colossus. Colossus is an interesting character, but it's only a matter of time before Colossus and Juggernaut have an actual brawl, because they've done that.
Yep. The actor wore a foam latex muscle suit covered with a chrome plate, plastic plus a hard plastic head to have the metal skin look on set with some digital augmentations later on. For his stuff like with the wires, the quote-unquote the fastball special where Colossus throws Wolverine.
I love me a good fastball.
I will say that at the time, this is probably the best portrayal of Colossus until the later installments of the series. But as I will say, he did fine. I really don't think about him in the original trilogy that much.
Me neither, if I'm being honest.
We have Ben Foster as Angel. Let me tell you, I love Ben Foster. He is a really underrated actor for a lot of the movies I've seen him in. Let me tell you, aside from this movie, just the sheer amount of ways that he's stopped me watching one of his performances, I'd be like, okay, is there like a movie going on? Because it's like, is he done talking? Because I kind of want him to keep talking. It's like, but in this movie, he barely has anything to do.
Yeah,
like,
and he plays Angel, who, may I remind you, is a prominent founding member of the X-Men.
Yep, he's literally there to show one of the coolest shots ever, his angel wings fluttering out. He's there to fly and say, he's there to help sometimes. He has maybe less than 10 lines in the whole hour, 45-minute movie. Yeah,
that's so kind of sad.
He really comes off as wasted potential. Mostly to see as him flying over the recently fixed Golden Gate Bridge at the end of the movie.
Yeah, so, that's really it.
As you're like, I will say this right now. This is a much more positive thing that I'll be saying in later installments. They really wasted Angel in these movies.
Tell me about it.
Because let me tell you, again, Angel is one of my favorite parts of the X-Men story. Seeing a good guy go bad in the worst possible way is great for me.
Also when they're not trying to do an alternate universe.
Yes, definitely so. So I will say Ben Foster is a phenomenal actor who did the best he could with what limited material he had in this. So I'll say if you liked what little he did in this, go watch his other films, including Hell or High Water.
I heard that one was really good.
Yep. Now we have we had his father. We had Callisto, the leader of the Morlocks. She was fine.
Let me tell you.
I'm really not a big fan of the Morlocks, honestly.
Me neither.
They're fine.
Like, they're okay characters, but they don't have a lot going for them.
Believe it or not, Ramirez, the actress who played Callisto in this movie, originally auditioned to play the mutant prostitute Stacy X. And impressed Brett Ratner so much when she auditioned that he gave her the job of Callisto.
I'm going to stop you right there. Mutant prostitute?
Stacy X. Yeah,
that's a thing?
She has a whole page dedicated to her. She was created 20 years ago in
2001. Oh, God.
So clearly she was a new age idea that just took off.
Well, that makes sense.
So basically, Callisto was there. Dr. Rivedo Rao. Okay, that's actually another weird thing going in there. We had Joseph Summers, the president of the United States, is tolerant of mutants, but fearful of the Brotherhood of Mutants. While crafting the character, the producers felt that a different president, like an African-American or a woman, had become cliché. That was his excuse, saying,
what?
We can't give the X-Men universe a female or black president because it's cliché, because everybody's doing it.
Do they not realize that we didn't get a black president until 2009?
Exactly, because like the fact of the matter is, it became a thing. They're basically justifying it, saying, it hasn't happened in real life. So it's still a work of fantasy until it actually happened. So I'm just really, because, yo, okay, even though I will be the first to say that even though nowadays we're now 15 years after this movie's come out, that maybe having a differently ethnic president is like become cliche now. Definitely not so in 2006.
No, not at all.
We got Trask. Remember Trask?
Boulevard Trask. It looked totally different than what we saw in the future.
Yep. Multiple Man in this movie. He was cool. I would have loved to see the movie that they were going to make about him.
They were
going to
make a movie about him?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that would have been awesome.
He's so fun. He's such a douche with how much he's able to multiply himself and do all these different things. They basically had different symbols on, like, his outfits, because, like...
You know, like, were they, like, different numbers?
Yeah, they said, the writers considered Dane's performance, Eric Dane, who played Multiple Man, memorable, despite being featured in only two scenes in the movie.
What?
Basically, the wardrobe invoked the symbols worn in his comic costume. So, yeah, they said that he did a great job, despite only being in less than 5 minutes of the movie.
It's really a big shame
right there. Characters like Psylocke, Arc-alike, Kid, Omega, Quill, Leech, of course, is there. They had a lot of X-Men characters in the background, but they're never named. I don't know who they are if you don't name them.
Yeah.
And you're like, and of course, many of the people who have the cameos in here, they don't have credits. They don't have Wikipedia pages. I can't look up what they look like unless I really, really look. And I really, really don't want to unless I feel obliged to do so.
Yeah.
Of course, we have Moira McTaggart in this movie. Avalanche and Vanisher are in this film. Like, it's just so many cameos. Jubilee, once again, is in this movie, and she does nothing.
Yeah, Jubilee, justice for Jubilee. I'm starting that now. Hashtag justice for Jubilee.
They really did her and Angel dirty in these movies.
Yeah, look,
they
let's be honest. So again, hard. We're going to say this again, time and time again. The best incarnations of them are the animated series from the 90s.
And now some more fun cameos. Arlie Ermey was actually the leader of the sergeant directing the forces trying to stop Magneto on Alcatraz.
Oh, of course.
He was such an icon. Yeah. I will honestly forever miss him. And who could forget Stan Lee and Chris Claremont's cameos as Jean's neighbors in the 1986 flashback.
Yeah.
Oh my god. I love seeing those guys every single which way. If we're doing a Marvel movie, we will hella call out Stan Lee whenever we see him.
Yeah, that's true.
I know that I was going to make another point, but I honestly forgot what I was going to be posting. I'm pretty sure it had something to do with the CG on the younger versions of Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart.
It was not good. Movie.
No, it was not great. I mean, Patrick Stewart was fine, but Ian McKellen, they had a really hard time.
He kind of stuck out like a sore thumb.
He really, really did. And who can forget, they teased the Sentinels in this movie, in the Danger Room.
We
did finally see the Danger Room in this movie.
Even though
it's only used for one scene and never used again. It's such a big shame. You introduce great things and never do anything with them.
Yeah, it's like they have set up great things for it and there's no payoff.
I know, right? Honestly. Now, of course, one of my favorite parts is when we talk about the accolades before we move on to our final thoughts.
Accolades, please.
A little fun fact. Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry, and Kelsey Grammer actually were present at an advanced screening on a naval warship supporting the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, saluting that the X-Men support America's troops. That's actually pretty funny. Not gonna lie, that's actually pretty funny. So I'm gonna go through the film's awards very briefly. The costume designer was nominated for an Excellence in Costume Design for Film Fantasy, Costume Designers Guild Awards. The film and The Dark Phoenix and The Professor X Showdown were actually nominated for Best Scene of the Year and Best Sci-Fi Fantasy of the Year at the Empire Awards. Ian McKellen was nominated for a Best International Actor at the Irish Film and TV Awards.
Okay, that ain't so bad.
Halle Berry won a Favorite Female Action Star at the People's Choice Awards.
Okay.
Let's talk about this. Kelsey Grammer was nominated for a Best Supporting Saturn Award.
That's not bad.
Famic Jensen won a Best Supporting Actress Saturn Award that year.
I'm surprised.
Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry, the movie, Ian McKellen, they were all nominated for Teen Choice Awards, but they didn't win any.
I didn't think so.
For choice action movie, action movie star, action movie actress, action movie rumble, choice villain, all that stuff. And of course, the young kid who, I believe the kid who played Jimmy, the
Leech.
Yeah, Leech. He actually was nominated for a Best Supporting Young Actor at the Young Actors, at the Young Artist Awards. So tons of nomination, very few wins for this movie.
Yeah, I thought so.
But still, at the very least, it was recognized to the very bitter end. So now that we've gone over the actors, the plot, how we feel about that, the way things are going forward, let us talk about and wind down with our final thoughts for X-Men 3 The Last Stand. Chris, what do you think?
Like I said earlier, it's like Mega Man 5. It's just there. This movie is... I mean, it's not horrible. It could have been worse.
Could have been way worse.
But, like... You're trying to incorporate the Dark Phoenix saga in what is possibly an anti-discriminatory PSA movie.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't correlate well.
It just stops the movie. It diverges it down a path it was never meant to go down.
And the fact,
not yet.
With Jean's new power, she stands with Magneto, and she's there on the assault on Alcatraz Island with the Brotherhood of Mutants. It's a little weird, but I mean, I guess it's plot convenience. But the rest of it just... And not to mention that meme, which we can't say because it's a little out there. Yeah, but it's funny, but... Ugh.
It's the meme, man.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, look, the acting is still strong. Yeah. Characters have good relations. And I will admit, some of the action is still really good to watch. Like, again, I bring up Magneto moving the bridge.
Exactly.
That was great.
Yes.
And the final battle on Alcatraz Island was great. But not to mention the fact, Angel and Jubilee wasted in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact... Rogue's thinking, her logic is almost as bad as Tony's in Iron Man 2.
I know, it's so bad. Like, really, Anna, I love you, darling, but why would
yeah,
you do this?
Yeah, because, look, if you want to see Anna Paquin in a recent movie, go see American Underdog. She's in that movie, and she did a good job.
Shout out for her in that.
Yeah, but this movie just has too much. Like, it tries to focus too much on the Dark Phoenix saga, as well as that Cure storyline. Like, as Mike said earlier, if this movie focused more on the Cure and nothing on Jean, I feel like it would have been a little bit better.
It would have been much better. I do think, arguably, it would not be as good as the first two movies.
No, of course not. I'm not saying that at all. Like, yeah, because we're going to say this in regard. We both love X2.
Yes.
This was just a real downgrade.
It really was.
But and overall, it's still not awful.
No, it's not
an awful movie. But if I had to go final rating on it, like if you want to watch it, go right ahead. But I feel like you're just going to feel like it's going to be something you might want to turn your brain off, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, just like enjoy it for the action, not for the story.
Yeah. So overall, with rating wise, I'll be nice and give X-Men The Last Stand around a 7 out of 10.
All right, then. Now, folks, you know me as the kind of guy who likes to dig deep into the different aspects and themes about a movie, see what it means for pop culture, all things considered, for the now, the past, and the future. Now, for me, X3 just seemed like a movie that was hindered due to many unforeseen circumstances. Had those circumstances been different, we would have gotten a much better movie, but unfortunately, we have to look at what we have. It's a film that's cluttered with way too much going on. However, with all the cast still as passionate as ever, trying to make an amazing story and basically conclude the first big arc that's been building since the films first started back in 2000. The actors are strong, the characterization is weird, the character deaths were a bit off-putting, and a lot of the choices by both the main and minor characters still grip with me to this day. But I still think this movie is overall okay.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it.
One thing that I finally remembered, the thing I forgot. You guys want to know why Nightcrawler is not in this movie despite being introduced in X2? There is a reason for that, and it's very lackluster why Alan Cumming is not in this movie.
Let me guess, he also decided to join Superman Returns?
No, he didn't want to work on the third movie if Bryan Singer was not directing it. So
actually, that's loyalty right there.
Yeah, so basically he said, if Bryan's not doing it, you can count me out, and they wrote Nightcrawler out of the story in one of the X-Men video games that were coming out on consoles at the time about him not wanting to be a member of the X-Men anymore because of his pacifism. And you're like, it was a,
seriously?
Yep. They basically said that if you didn't play the game, you have no idea why he's not here. And it's such a big disappointment.
Oh, great.
Especially since I have very little good things to say about Alan Cumming, but I will say he did great in X2.
Yeah, his Nightcrawler was great.
Yes.
Now him not being here, it's just... think that's what was one of the missing things.
It's definitely one of the missing things. I'll always consider Alan Cumming the original Nightcrawler.
Of course,
the founding Nightcrawler right there. So I will say that this movie is a story about society making one last great push to change those who are different for the better, still not fully understanding why those unique things make them special in the first place. Having to see so many people's lives being lost, nearly losing the entire planet and all things our heroes hold dear, friends and family both, for mutants to finally get the rights they deserved, but not really, as we'll see in future movies.
Oh, yeah.
So I will say this is a flawed movie, but it's still an okay watch for fans of the franchise to get through, because there are much worse movies than this to come in the X-Men saga,
my friends. This movie will anger you, but not too much.
Yes. So I'll, and you guys know me, you may scream, you may shout about my letter rankings, but I stand true and true by them to the very end.
Because there are opinions.
I will give X-Men 3, The Last Stand, directed by Brett Ratner, a letter D ranking.
Really? You put it on the same level as Man of Steel?
No. Man of Steel was D+.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Yikes.
Yeah, so basically those are our big rankings on the ending of the original X-Men trilogy. Our next big film review will be the third installment of the DC Cinematic Universe, 2016's Suicide Squad, directed by David Ayer.
Oh, what could have happened there? That is going to be fun to discuss.
It's going
to
be very fun.
But, of course, we'll also be back with wrapping up, finally, Batman the Animated Series and talking about looking back on the show and some of our favorite episodes and some of our not-so-favorite episodes from the show.
Yep.
But that's all for next time and the future. Until then, I'm Chris.
I'm Mike.
We hope you guys have a safe and happy new year. We'll see you all in 2022. Have a good night, everybody.
Peace, my brothers and sisters. Bye-bye.